Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Twitter prepares employees for a wave of layoffs today. Plus, contract talks between U.S. airlines and pilots hit a snag. And U.S. and EU officials convene to avert a trade fight over EV tax breaks.
It's a little hard to know how much of it was intentional and aimed at promoting U.S. industry at the expense of others, or if it was a focus on promoting U.S. industry and there was collateral damage.
It's Friday, November 4th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. And here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The U.S. and its allies have agreed on key details of a price cap on Russian oil, which is set to go into effect on December 5th. According to people familiar with the matter, each load of seaborne Russian oil will only be subject to the price cap when it is first sold to a buyer on land, meaning that resales of the same oil won't have to fall under the cap. Under the price cap plan, Group of Seven advanced democracies and Australia also plan to bar firms in their countries from providing key maritime services like insurance for the shipment of Russian oil unless it's sold below a set price. Journal reporter Julie Steinberg has more.
Some key details still need to be worked out, including the actual price for the price cap, though the U.S. and its allies hope to agree on that level in the coming weeks. And, of course, the U.S.'s foreign partners are still also finalizing enforcement details.
Russian officials have threatened to cut their oil production in retaliation for the price cap, though U.S. officials say they believe Russia won't risk damaging a critical industry. Employees of social media company Twitter are bracing for a round of layoffs today, a week after billionaire Elon Musk acquired the company. In an email sent to staff yesterday and seen by the Wall Street Journal, Twitter said employees would receive a message by 9 a.m. Pacific time Friday about whether they were affected, stating that staff reductions were intended to place Twitter on a healthy path. The company did not spell out the extent of the cuts. On Wednesday, employees and people familiar with the situation were sharing estimates ranging from more than 2,000 to nearly 3,750 layoffs, the latter equating to about half of the number of employees that Twitter had at the beginning of the year. Yesterday's email also said that Twitter's offices would be temporarily closed to ensure the safety of employees, the company's systems, and customer data. Meanwhile, we are exclusively reporting that Audi, Pfizer, food company General Mills, and Oreo maker Mondelez International have joined a growing list of companies that have temporarily paused their Twitter ads, according to people familiar with the matter. Some advertisers are concerned that Musk could scale back content moderation, while others are pausing ads on Twitter due to uncertainty at the company as top executives exit and Musk considers a raft of changes, some of the people said. Representatives for General Mills and Audi of America confirmed the companies have paused Twitter ads. A Twitter representative didn't respond to a request for comment. A New York judge has ordered former President Donald Trump's family business to be subject to monitoring requirements while it faces a civil fraud lawsuit from New York Attorney General Letitia James. Citing persistent misrepresentations in financial statements by the Trump's family business over the last decade, State Supreme Court Justice Arthur Engoron said appointing an independent monitor was a prudent way of ensuring no further fraud or illegality. A Trump Organization spokeswoman said the decision sets a dangerous precedent for government interference in private enterprise and said it is an obvious attempt to influence the outcome of the upcoming election, while Trump, in a statement, called the decision ridiculous and unprecedented. And in other market news today, the Labor Department is set to report on the state of the U.S. labor market in October, including job gains, the unemployment rate, and worker earnings. It has been a bumpy year for air travel between long lines, staff shortages, canceled flights, and lost bags, just to name a few lowlights. Now add into the mix contract talks between carriers and pilots that have turned acrimonious in recent weeks. So could that spell more disruption to the industry and more headaches for travelers? Wall Street Journal air travel reporter Allison Sider joins us now with the latest. Hi, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
So take us into these ongoing talks between pilots and U.S. carriers. Where do things stand?
So, you know, pilots, unions, and airlines renegotiate their contracts every couple of years. And those talks were kind of just gearing up to get going right when the pandemic hit. And then airlines were fairly distracted dealing with the complete disappearance of travel demand and everything got put on hold for a couple of years. And now things are spooling up again. Airlines and pilots unions have been in talks, you know, for the last several months, for most of this year. And the talks are, they're not going especially well right now. And there's been a sort of growing acrimony on both sides.
What specifically do pilots want out of this?
Sure. So, of course, pay is always a big part of these negotiations. And the airlines have made already some pretty significant offers of pay raises. The one big pilot contract that has gotten done is at Alaska Airlines. And their pilots are getting raises, in some cases, more than 20%. Other airlines like American, they've offered pilots raises of around 20% over the next 2 years. So some of the pay issues, you know, there's already some pretty big numbers floating out there. But the other thing pilots say they want are deeper changes to scheduling and work rules, things that will give them more flexibility, better quality of life. And that's something that kind of became an even bigger priority during the last couple of years. And as much as that's been really frustrating in some cases for passengers, you know, it also makes life harder for pilots.
And what have airlines said about that?
You know, they don't talk that much publicly about how the bargaining is going and what they're hung up on. But these scheduling issues can often be even thornier to resolve than pay, just because they require a lot of collaboration and sort of big changes and more complexity than just a pay raise.
Allison, given that you've reported that airlines say travel demand remains strong, why are we in this position where the two sides can't reach agreement?
Well, I think things have changed so rapidly. And then even in the last couple of months, you know, seeing the way inflation has taken off, seeing sort of the strength of the demand recovery the airlines are seeing, you know, what seemed like perhaps a generous or at least adequate offer 6 months ago, maybe no longer is very attractive to pilots. I think some of the unions feel that perhaps the airlines should be willing to open their wallets a little bit more and offer bigger contracts.
Finally, Allison, I've got to ask, if these talks don't get sorted out, is there a chance they could lead to yet more disruptions for travelers?
You know, I think for now, it doesn't seem likely there will be any disruptions for travelers, you know, at least imminently. You know, I think Thanksgiving and the holidays seem like they'll go fairly smoothly. At least I think the possibility for travel disruptions is somewhat remote for now, at least from this source.
That was Wall Street Journal air travel reporter Allison Sider. Allison, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, U.S. and EU officials are due to hold an urgent meeting today to defuse rising tensions that threaten to upset a trade relationship that leaders had pledged to rebuild. We've got that story after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
U.S. and EU officials are set to meet today in an attempt to resolve competing environmental policies that currently have them on a collision course. The main topic of discussion? U.S. clean energy tax credits included in the Inflation Reduction Act passed over the summer. Wall Street Journal reporter Kim McCrail is based out of our bureau in Brussels, and she joins us now with a look at the new U.S.-EU task force that is meant to avert a trade collision here. Kim, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what is this collision course, as you say, that the U.S. and EU appear to be set on here?
Yeah. So first of all, a large part of the goal of the Inflation Reduction Act is to push forward clean energy technology, which the EU is totally on board and interested in. The problem for the EU is that parts of this act include some tax credits that are only applicable if a product is made either in the US or in North America. And that means there are some European-made products that just wouldn't be able to qualify for those subsidies.
Yeah, so one provision here is an EV rebate, I guess, for vehicles. Tell us about sort of the specifics of some of the dollars and cents that's involved here.
So one of the provisions is it's an up to $7,500 tax rebate for electric vehicles if those vehicles are assembled in North America. So Europe has an active automotive industry, and there's a lot of concern that those vehicles, if they don't qualify for those subsidies, that there will be a slowdown in imports of those vehicles from Europe to the United States.
Kim, you say part of the goal of the Inflation Reduction Act and these tax rebates for electric vehicles was to encourage car manufacturing in North America. Was that specifically at the expense of Europe? Was that sort of the point of this?
It's a great question. And to be honest, it's a little hard to know how much of it was, you know, intentional and aimed at promoting U.S. industry at the expense of others, or if it was a focus on promoting U.S. industry and there was collateral damage there that wasn't necessarily fully thought through ahead of time. An interesting example of how this played out in North America is that Canada saw what was coming on the electric vehicle subsidy and lobbied really hard along with the North American automotive industry and managed to get kind of an exemption on this one. Where we're seeing with Europe, with Asia, this is still playing out even though the legislation has already been signed into law.
So tell us about these latest efforts to try to reconcile the US and the EU over this and what they're going to try to attempt here.
Yeah, so they've decided to set up a task force. You know, we don't know exactly what the deliverables of that task force will be, apart from talking through the U.S. view of the legislation, what they intend and hope to achieve from it, and opening up lines of communication. The EU is coming at this from a perspective of they would like to see European automakers get the same exemptions or, you know, be allowed to qualify for the subsidies the way Canada and Mexico have been allowed to qualify for the electric vehicle subsidies. I think EU officials also recognize that that's going to be a challenge. The legislation's already been signed into law, and they've said that's their starting point, but they recognize that they probably have to be realistic about this.
It makes me wonder if then every U.S. ally would then be asking for an exemption as well.
Right. And I think South Korea's automotive industry has asked for the same thing. And certainly South Korea and Japan, two major automotive manufacturing countries, are going to be watching very closely what unfolds between the EU and the US as they have their own conversations.
Finally, Kim, is it possible to say what might happen if the EU and US can't work something out here?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are some leaders who have been taking perhaps a much more critical line than some EU officials. French President Emmanuel Macron has talked about maybe the EU should actually retaliate with its own measures to support electric vehicles that are produced in Europe. That is not necessarily what everyone in the industry or in government would like to see. I think there are, you know, a variety of different views on how the EU should respond to this, but there is some pressure for some sort of bi-European response to this. And the other possibility is the EU a couple of months ago raised the possibility that they could bring this to the WTO. They think that there's a concern that it might not be compliant with WTO rules, and then that's an option for them as well.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Kim McCrail, based out of our bureau in Brussels. Kim, thank you for the update.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And finally, there's a delicate choreography to political campaigning as candidates attempt to connect with voters and demonstrate their realness via carefully scripted moments. And while voters may forgive lapses over policy details, they're often less forgiving over cultural faux pas. Like in 1976, when President Gerald Ford tried to eat a tamale in Texas without removing the outer corn husk. And that trend continues. This year, Ohio, Democratic U.S. Representative Tim Ryan attacked GOP opponent J.D. Vance for drinking wine and eating cheese in California, only for Vance's campaign to note that Ryan had released an ad featuring him and his wife opening a bottle of wine. While over in Pennsylvania, Republican Senate candidate Mehmet Oz was filmed visiting a supermarket to spotlight soaring grocery prices, only for viewers to focus more on why he was piling items into his arms instead of using a basket. Journal Food and Ag reporter Christina Peterson says there's something unique about how politicians relate to food that can so easily raise eyebrows.
There is a long history of candidates sort of stumbling over food and drink on the campaign trail. I think it had a special resonance this year because inflation really dominated a lot of the campaign messaging. I think it was 100,000 ad airings mentioned food or groceries. And there's just something kind of instinctual about our response to food. People know when a candidate gets it right and they know when they get it wrong. And so these incidents trigger a sense of people not knowing the unspoken rules.
And that's What's News for Friday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.